Welcome to Inspired by Kurosawa, where we're watching a Kurosawa film and then the films it inspired. Previously, we covered Rashomon and Seven Samurai. In our last episode, we covered The Hidden Fortress with Andrew Heaton. And now it's finally time for us to actually cover Star Wars itself. I'm your host, and I've been waiting to do this podcast since I was 10 years old. My co-host is Guy, who completed the Star Wars arcade game in less than 12 parsecs. And today we're joined by special guest Brian Dunning, who does the Skeptoid podcast.
Hello.
So first off, Brian, what's Skeptoid all about?
So Skeptoid has been my job since 2006. Have been going for quite some time. We look at things in pop culture where people have some belief, and whether that's an urban legend, a paranormal claim, a UFO, ghosts, Bigfoot, whatever it is, where there's a more interesting truth behind the popular fiction. And in doing this, we kind of get to learn how to tell what's real from what's not in the world. And when you know that, you're able to make better life decisions because you have a better knowledge base on which to base your decisions. So it's scientific skepticism is what we call it. And I think it's pretty important. And a lot of people really enjoy the process of trying to tell what's real from what's not.
Yeah, I've been, you know, almost from the beginning a listener of the podcast. I'm a big fan. And I always love the fact that, you know, there are skeptical podcasts who are like going to go on and on about how ghosts don't exist or whatever. But you always find these really interesting topics up to, you know, like dolphin combat or zombies or whatever.
So, well, we, you know, it's 900 and something shows now. And so there's and then the funny thing is there's no remote danger of running out of topics. There are so many things and so many just darn cool things to learn about in the world. I mean, you mentioned the dolphins. Dolphins that are used in military, you know, to plant mines and to find divers and things like that. How cool is that? And, you know, there's 900 other things equally cool.
Right.
Oh, yeah.
So to set the tone for this episode, in our last episode, we beat to death all the things that Lucas took from the Hidden Fortress.
We really talked more about Star Wars than the Hidden Fortress.
So, you know, C-3PO and R2-D2 are right out of the Hidden Fortress. So is Obi-Wan Kenobi, the Princess, Darth Vader, and, you know, numerous other things. Even a few things we missed, maybe we'll bring them up in this episode. But, you know, if Lucas had just done a remake of Hidden Fortress, Star Wars would never have had the impact it did because in the Kurosawa film, there was no Luke Skywalker. There was no hero's journey. So, in effect, a lot of the background story stuff he took, but then he added in this other stuff. And, you know, I know, Brian, when we talked, you were, you know, interested in that part. But before we get to all that, what's your sort of life experience with Star Wars?
Yeah, I mean, I can't deny it's been a significant part of my life, and it's still astounding to me that someone can make a movie the way George did, and so many countless people around the world will consider it an important part of their life. I mean, I remember I was 11 when I saw it at the big Newport Cinema in Newport Beach, California. I even remember the standing in line part. The whole experience burned itself in my memory so deeply. I even remember that. I remember thinking, when I saw the X-Wings flying around, I thought that was the coolest design I'd ever seen in my life for anything. I resolved to draw it, and I spent the rest of my life ever since then drawing X-Wings in great detail. I've got a Lego X-Wing hanging from the ceiling in my office right now.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, I mean, I could go on and on. When I went to high school, we lived in the Bay Area, and a couple of friends and I were so obsessed with Star Wars and ILM in general that we used to go and dig through the dumpsters when they were closed at night and playing evasion from their security guards. And we would go. We found all kinds of great stuff. I mean, I could spend an entire hour just talking about our adventures digging through the dumpsters at ILM. So yeah, I'm a Star Wars junkie to some degree for sure.
So, Guy, what's your experience?
I saw it when I was 7, which was the year it came out, though I don't think I saw it till later in the year, several months after it had been out. Actually, I think my dad had gone to see it with his brother, and they decided that I should see it, too. I fell in love with it. Just I hadn't been that interested in it. A friend of mine who lived down the street, he had seen the Coming Soon posters months before, and he was all excited about it. And there was this poster that was just like 8 pictures. There was like 2 columns of 4 stills from the movie. And he was fascinated by that, and I looked at it, and it just left me cold. Then when I actually saw it, it was... I was enthralled, and then I got in trouble for it because in my second grade class I would draw cartoons of C-3PO and Darth Vader and R2-D2 when I was supposed to be paying attention.
Well, I was 9 or 10, and a couple of friends of mine were begging their parents to go see this film again, which intrigued me. Right, so that was the start of that. Kids today who watch all this can't possibly understand how different this was or what the impact was, right? Because all of modern media, it's so easy to see spaceships flying around, et cetera. And even that first shot and how incredible it is, because first you see Leia's ship and it's being fired on, and then the Imperial ship goes over and it just keeps going. And people were just freaked out by that, right? I mean, nobody had ever seen this huge spaceship, you know, just going and going, and nobody had ever seen a shot like that to begin a film.
And that was an incredible experience, seeing that spaceship coming over your head. I remember I was terrified.
that was my X-Wing, was the Imperial Star Destroyer. That was my favorite.
Right. And it so communicated what was going on, because you have the smaller ship and this great larger ship that's attacking it. Like, you immediately start to understand the situation, right? And the interesting thing is, all the stuff in the beginning is unique to this, but once C-3PO and R2-D2 are on the surface, that's where the Hidden Fortress starts, right? And literally those two characters are part of it. You have the tall guy and the short guy, and the tall guy is, you know, the C-3PO character is all nervous about everything, and then they separate and they get reconnected. All that stuff happens.
The neurotic droid.
Yeah. Although the short guy, the equivalent of R2-D2, that's completely changed in Star Wars, right? Because in Star Wars, R2-D2 knows what's going on. He has these secret plans, etc. And none of that's there. Although, I was thinking about it because, again, watching the actual film after having watched Hidden Fortress, their equivalent in Hidden Fortress of the Death Star plans is they have come up with this creative idea about how to cross the borders so they don't go through the hostile border. And it's kind of silly because they're like, you know, if we don't just directly attack the hostile border, if we go around it, that will let us get to our destination. And the Obi-Wan Kenobi character is like, oh my God, I never thought of that. So that's sort of the equivalent of the Death Star plan is this idea for how to go around the hostile border.
It's even the hostile border is actually between the hero's country and their allied country, because somehow the evil country has come down and infiltrated and is somehow monitoring that border. And so they actually have to go up into the evil country, which is easier than going across the border with the evil people patrolling it. So it's, I'm not sure. Maybe I misunderstood it, but that's how I remember it. Odd setup, anyway.
One of the funny things we talked about in our last episode is that Lucas, while acknowledging his debt to this film, and he also... He and Coppola funded one of Kurosawa's last films out of appreciation for the impact that he'd had on them. So Lucas never denied the influence of Kurosawa. But he said in an interview, oh, the princess thing was a coincidence that I had a princess and Hidden Fortress had a princess. And it's totally bullshit because the princess in Hidden Fortress is this very strong-willed, take no shit, you know, woman, which is exactly, you know, not exactly, but, you know, very close to Princess Leia. And also the whole story evolves around protecting her as she needs to get to her destination. But all that said, like I mentioned, there's no Luke Skywalker. There's no, you know, hero's journey. And I know, Brian, you come from this more from the...
Joseph Campbell
yeah. approach. So what's your thoughts about that?
Yeah, my background is in, my educational background is in writing for film and television, which I did at UCLA. So it's interesting. I came into science writing. Most science writers come into it via science. I came into it via writing. But one of the most influential things that happened to me in that program was when one of the professors handed out Chris Vogler's little, 5 or 10 page, a practical guide to the hero with 1,000 faces, which is just a wonderful, wonderful document. I think this was a mimeograph off of Chris Vogler's original. I assume many of your listeners know what a mimeograph is.
Probably they don't.
Yeah, the old purple ink.
The purple ink melt like glue.
Yeah, people used to distribute newsletters by running them through a mechanical process that would duplicate them before photocopiers were affordable, yeah.
The neat thing about Chris Vogler's sort of, you know, condensed version of The Hero with 1,000 Faces is it uses Star Wars as one of the examples. So for each of the 12 steps of the hero's journey, he would give what that was in Star Wars. You know, there's the trash compactor scene, which is the hero's deepest, darkest moment of death, you know. And then there's the characters like the wise old man. Mm-hmm. Well, we all know who the wise old man was in Star Wars. And it just matches up so perfectly. And really seeing that document and how Star Wars matched up with it ignited a real passion in me for story structure. And ever since then, I've looked at every movie I've seen in terms of the structure of its story. We learned all these different kinds of diagrams. I know this is terrible because writing is supposed to be, you know, a real organic and artistic process, but there's also this sort of mechanical craft to story construction. And Star Wars is such the absolutely perfect seminal example of that, that it's another reason that it's just like I say, an important part of my life.
Yeah, I was... So, like, you know, Sid Meier's a famous person who wrote a book about screenwriting that, that many people use. And I feel like there's a tension between understanding the common structure of stories throughout time and going too far. So for me, Sid Meier goes a bit too far because he's like, on page 23, you need to do this, right? Like, okay, no, you know, that gets kind of silly. On the other hand, I noticed, especially today watching this, so it's an almost exactly 2-hour film. Every 30 minutes, exactly on the 30-minute point, something really significant in the film happens, right? So it feels structured that way. But the other thing is, especially if you watch a lot of the background materials and everything, and Red Letter Media has covered this a lot, you know, it was a terrible, terrible film to start with. I mean, it had terrible acting, all sorts of characters that were, you know, like the prequels of, you know, I consider the prequels to have terrible acting in many cases. And it was Lucas's wife and his friends who restructured the film to get rid of all the crap and give us what we got, right? But if we had just gotten the film that he would have done, it would have been terrible. On the other hand, having watched all this stuff, I will say, in Lucas's defense, I mean, the film never could have been completed without him because he just had to power through all these things. So, you know, he got back from filming in Tunisia and they had been working on the infrastructure for the special effects, but they only had like 4 shots done of the special effects. And he then had to work with them and get it finished, right? So while I feel like creatively, he had a lot of dumb ideas that a lot of his collaborators managed to shave off of the film to make it work. Also, the film couldn't have been completed if he hadn't just had, you know, barreled through and done all of these things. So it's kind of a, you know, it's always an interesting question. And, you know, to me, one of the problems with the prequel series is at that point, none of the people, so he had divorced his wife and all that. So he had nobody to tell him no as he was making these like offensive Chinese characters and, you know, all this other crap. So I don't know. I will never give up on the idea that the prequel series was crap, even if people have been reconsidering it in the face of the
final series. You're preaching to the choir here, Ron.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'd say it's fun crap.
You mentioned the special effects, and I have to give my fun John Dykstra anecdote. Part of the one of the advantages of living in the Bay Area during my high school years is our substitute teacher in our art class once was John Dykstra's wife.
Wow.
And she was telling us that, and I was the only person in the class who had any idea who John Dykstra was. So
that's where he's a guy.
Well, and as I recall, having read so goddamn much about, you know, the background, there's this amazing series of books, three books done by an archivist at Lucasfilm. And the great things about these books is they're done from the time all the interviews and everything are contemporaneous, so they don't have any of the bullshit that people added in after the fact, right? Mm-hmm. And they're really, really fascinating. So Dykstra, for example, was hugely important in Star Wars. He came up with these whole new technologies, like the motion capture camera, which was, you know, named after him. But he also didn't get things done on time and everything, so Lucas fired him after the first film, and that was hugely devastating to him. And, you know, to this day, his cameras and his techniques are still used that he came out for Star Wars. But
wow, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
A question on the special effects. So we were all pretty much in the same age range when we first saw Star Wars. I'm curious what your guys' impressions of the special effects were. I can tell you mine was that as an 11-year-old boy, I thought they must have actually had to go into space to make those shots.
I thought when I watched it last night, I was very impressed by how well everything held up. I mean, some of those sandcrawler scenes early on, it looks like they had a full-size sandcrawler rolling over the dunes. I could spot a lot of things, like where the green screen type thing isn't right. You know, the spaceships have a little bit of an outline around,
the stuff like that. Yeah,
but
yeah.
You know, there's nothing terribly bad. And especially for 1977, I mean, it's really pretty solidly done. You know, with minor things here and there, but I thought it held up really well. I enjoyed the whole
thing. Well, the way I would put it is, if you remember when Superman came out, the promotional campaign was, "You'll believe a man can fly."
Yeah.
And that's what Star Wars did. I mean, just the idea of all this space stuff and everything, it seemed so real that it was just incredible. It just, that's what was different from anything else before it. And it's, and again, the more you know about the background story and how nothing was working, et cetera, the fact that they pulled all that off in the end was just incredible. But they created this environment. And also the thing that Marcia Lucas, who edited the film, took out entire characters, which was, it hurt the film a bit because the final sequence where they're doing the trench run, which is, and I was watching, it's just incredibly edited. I mean, just amazing how that was edited and how suspenseful that was and everything. It doesn't matter that now you can. So I watch, I don't know if Guy, if you watched off my server, but I watch what's called the Harmy's de-specialized version, where they take the best versions of Star Wars, but they take out all the crap that George added in the specialized thing. And you can see in their shots where it's like, oh yeah, clearly these spaceships were composited onto here or whatever. The editing and the flow is just so good. And, you know, it wasn't there when they first started working with all this. And I'd say, you know, also the interesting thing to me is with Lucas and Spielberg, they really got famous doing films that recreated things they'd watched in their childhood, right? These old TV shows and movies. And that's a lot of what was happening here. Originally, this was supposed to be a Flash Gordon movie, but he couldn't get the rights to Flash Gordon. Mm-hmm. So he had to create his own IP, which turned out pretty well. And, you know, it'd be funny. I mean, now, and I actually love the actual Flash Gordon film that eventually got made, especially with the Queen soundtrack and everything. I love that.
Never saw it.
Oh, you never? Oh, my God. We're going to have to put that in the podcast.
I've heard the Flash Gordon song that Queen did. But
Oh, my God. We got to watch that. And that's kind of, but the thing is, even though I love that film, that's kind of what George Lucas set out to make. And instead of being this, you know, cult whatever, he created this society-changing thing, which he never wanted, right? I mean, he was like an experimental filmmaker, and he was making documentaries and everything. So it's kind of weird that he ended up making this pop culture thing, because that's not what he wanted to do, right? And he literally spent decades basically trying to escape it until he finally sold it to Disney. So speaking of which, so here's my rating of film. So how's it compared to you guys? I like, obviously, the first one because it created the universe, and that's an amazing thing. Empire Strikes Back. And then I don't like the third one. Rogue One, to me, is the third film, which I think is really good. And the first season of The Mandalorian. And aside from that, I don't really care about any Star Wars stuff.
Yeah, I can see that. I put the first three films in order, 1, 2, 3. As the best, and Rogue One, I would put fourth. I saw the Han Solo movie. I only saw it once, but I remember thinking it was not as bad as I thought it was going to be. It exceeded my expectations, but I had very low expectations.
I went into it knowing nothing. So first of all, I knew nothing about it, and I went to the theater, and there was nobody else in the theater. nobody was watching this. But what pisses me off about that film, first of all, it started with the directors who did the Miles Morales, you know, Across the Spider-Verse, which is an incredible movie. I mean, it's just one of the best movies of, like, the last 50 years, you know, an animated film and everything. And they fired them. And the result was a film about Han Solo. It was like, oh, why don't we talk about where he and, you know, Chewbacca meet? And why don't we do it? And, like, the last thing you want with a character with a background like Han Solo is to answer those questions.
Yeah.
That's an interesting point. I agree.
You should introduce new questions, but you should not say, oh, here's how they met. And I had never even thought about the fact, even though it's so obvious, until that movie, I never thought about the fact that Han Solo meant that he was a lone guy, but they were like, oh, you're alone. We'll call you Han Solo. And it was like, oh, God. So I hated all those things about that film.
Can I mention, you brought up the Flash Gordon song in Queen, which kind of opens the door to the music in Star Wars, is, of course, I mean, it changed film music. If you want to talk about its impact on pop culture and its impact on Hollywood, making film music truly a real character in the film. Been great composers in the past. You had Bernard Herrmann in all the Hitchcock films. You had Korngold. But it really wasn't until Star Wars. And we all remember that instant where the word Star Wars filled the screen and the music started. That was impactful.
And I feel that's one of the amazing, lucky or whatever things that Lucas had, because both he and Spielberg, you know, used the composer, what's his name?
John Williams.
And also he had Ben Bird doing the sound effects.
You're not talking about John Williams. You wouldn't have said
John Williams.
Are you kidding me?
And Ben Burtt doing the special effects. Yeah. Or the sound effects.
The sound effects, uh-huh.
Without both of those people, the movie would not have succeeded. I mean, not even possible. In the same way that Jaws would not have succeeded without John Williams doing the soundtrack. Yeah. And that's why I feel like Lucas was so freaking lucky to have these collaborators. Because it could have easily been a third-tier science fiction film without stuff.
It was an incredibly fortuitous confluence of all of these people at their absolute peak of creativity at a time when, I mean, a lot of mountains had not been climbed in Hollywood, and a lot of them were climbed in Star Wars. It really set a standard. I mean, it changed so much. It was just so friggin' good.
Yeah, it's one of those movies where everything, and I was thinking this watching it last night, I was curious to see whether I'd still think of it this way, because it's been several years since the last time I saw it. Everything, the music, even the acting may not be great, but the characters, the people are memorable and they fit the roles, you know. And the story keeps moving. It's briskly paced. The production design, of course, is just out of this world. You know, all the little, used future look.
That was a brand new idea. Because you want most science fiction before that, everything was shiny, new. And Lucas really did bring that old weathered thing to it, and that's to his credit. Talking about the actors, so first of all, you have, like, Mark Hamill, who's, one of his very first films ever. And, the newer actors, I mean, they did as well as they could. You have, like, Leia, she starts out with a British accent, and then she drops that later.
Sort of the mid-Atlantic accent.
Through your fingers.
Yeah, exactly. your foul stench when I came on board, and all that. But then one of the things they really benefited was, they filmed this in England, and they had these mature England actors. So what's his name who... who was Doctor Who in the movies and
Peter Cushing?
Yeah, Peter Cushing did a great job as the evil
Grand Moff Tarkin.
Yeah, he's terrific.
But also Alec Guinness. First of all, he thought this was a silly movie. He kind of did it on a lark, and I've mentioned this anecdote before. There was a guy who went to a signing with him, and he's like, "I've seen Star Wars 100 times. He says, "Promise me you'll never watch it again." Right? He hated it. But here's the funny thing. First of all, he did it. I mean, just it is that absolute British mature actor thing. He pulled off these lines like, Mos Eisley is the scum, height of scum and villainy or whatever. Like, these are terrible lines that he totally sold.
Oh, yeah. And he projected this... this warmth that, I kind of remembered from the earlier of watchings, but I really noticed it this time where he just came across as this kind, wise old man, which is exactly what he was supposed to be. It was whatever he may have thought about the movie, he didn't shirk on the performance side of it, I don't think.
So funny thing about this, Lucas felt he'd been so helpful in the process of making the movie that they called him up, and they offered him 2% of the profits. And so, then later, when the film was hugely successful, they called him up and said, "We said 1%, right?" So I have no idea. I don't know if they ever sold out or anything. I have no idea what his estate is getting, but 2% of Star Wars is pretty fucking huge.
Oh, yeah.
And again, I mean, the movie wouldn't work nearly as well without his portrayal. Although it's interesting, really interesting to watch, like, his fight with Darth Vader now, they had that fight in Hidden Fortress. But it wasn't with swords. We always think of lightsabers as, swords. It was with spears.
Right.
And it's a pretty amazing scene, and it's really complicated. And it turns out very differently because at the end in Hidden Fortress, Obi-Wan Kenobi, the equivalent, wins. Mm-hmm. And he then, dishonors Darth Vader, the equivalent, because he doesn't kill him. And by not killing him, that's actually worse, right? Because it's like you're not even worth killing, like it was, in the Japanese sense. And then later, the Darth Vader character shows up with scars across his face because his own people attacked him because of his dishonor in that fight, so that pays off in, the next film, Empire Strikes Back, or actually, I guess the third film, where we finally see Darth Vader's face and he's all scarred up. But, you know, the interesting thing watching it now is it, compared to films these days with all the, you know, Japanese and some degree Chinese experience combat, it was so primitive. The fight that he and Vader had was very primitive compared to any kind of fight you would see now. Mm-hmm. If you watch carefully, you can even see, because they were fighting with these things extended from the lightsaber that had powder on them. So when they would connect, this powder would come off. And if you watch carefully in the earlier versions of the film, like the de-specialized, you can see the powder coming off of these things.
No, that you make an interesting point talking about the how we would watch that now, and it's a relatively lame sword fight, right? Mm-hmm. And if you look at the progression over the course of the Star Wars movies that they've made over time, they peaked, I would say, in about Return of the Jedi. That was about as good as the lightsaber battles got. And then in the newer movies, they had to say, oh, we got to top that. They gave that Darth Maul guy the two-ended one, you know, with the blades coming out the sides.
Although a lot of people would say that the Darth Maul fight was one of the best fights in all of
It strayed too far into unrealistic, like, martial arts movie, people spinning around in the air and things like this. That's just not dramatic. That's just fiction, and it's not real, and it's not visceral, and it's not scary.
There's a great YouTube channel called Corridor Crew, where they've done films and they've worked with sword experts and everything to show what would actually happen if you had a fight with these. And, you know, basically people would be, you know, chopping off their arms or whatever.
Yeah, I would not want a two-ended lightsaber. You thrust your opponent with that. I'm glad you mentioned the despecialized versions, because that's the version that I watch as well. And I know they were making a 4K version, the 4K 77, which I downloaded at some point, and I didn't care for it as much. It was much too grainy for me. And for me, the 720p version of the Hermes despecialized is the best looking. And that's what I have for
the one we watched had a few shots, or at least that I watched. I don't know if, Guy, if you watched it off my server, if you did.
I watched the.
There were certain scenes where the lighting was really bad. It was really dark, and I don't know what was up with that. But what I really appreciate is that the despecialized removed all this extra crap, and so again, this is a case where if you're a person new to this, or you're young and you watch it and you watch all the stuff that he put in, you probably wouldn't notice. But
yeah.
What I notice, having seen it from the beginning, is when there are five extra Banthas in the background, or there's this thing going, it's like the shot was not composed for that.
Yeah.
And so it just throws me off, because I know what it looked like originally. And then when I see 20 extra things in the shot, I'm like, that's not what it was, and that's not what it was composed for. And it just pisses me off. You know,
and why? There's no reason why.
No, right. He's kind of like, this is what I had in my head originally or whatever, but that's not what it was framed for. Now, there are things I can appreciate. I mean, I don't totally disagree. Like, for example, originally, and you see this in the despecialized and some of them, when the land speeder is going along to hide the wheels, they literally just put Vaseline on the, you know, on the lens so that you couldn't see what was underneath the thing, right? So that's pretty primitive compared to now, where you just wipe it out. Although I still love seeing that, because of course I love seeing the practical aspect of it. But I would have no problem with saying, okay, I'm going to do a revised version where we take out the Vaseline, right? You know, okay, fine. It's not a big deal. But when you add in all this shit that wasn't there before, it just pisses me off.
Yeah. Well, I remember from the, 97, when they released the new digitally enhanced version, Mos Eisley, they added a lot of buildings, a lot of architecture, and a lot of stuff.
And a lot of shit going on where people were doing all this stuff in the background. Yeah. That had nothing to do with the story, that didn't, you know.
Yeah, watching this, I was amazed at what they did with Mos. I mean, it looked like they built sets for all those buildings with the domes in the background and stuff. Yep. I thought that it didn't really, Yeah, you didn't need to gild the lily there, I guess.
Yeah, and of course, then, I mean, it's one thing to talk about cosmetic stuff like that, but then he changed the story with, you know, the whole Han shoots first thing.
Yeah.
And, you know, the version we watched, he doesn't shoot first, but later he made, you know, Guido or the guy is shoot first. And it changes everything because the whole idea is that Hans is this rogue,
mm-hmm.
you know, who is going to shoot the other guy when he knows that that person's out to get him.
Yeah, he's a bad guy.
Yeah. And so it just, yeah, it just pissed me off. It's sort of like Spielberg with E.T., right? There was a point where a bunch of the guys were holding guns and they digitally changed into walkie-talkies. And it's like, I think he's kind of apologized for that after the fact. But yeah, I just, yeah, you know, I can't complain about the filmmaker revising things, because if you look at Blade Runner, there were like 7 different cuts of that film. And the final cut is honestly, in my opinion, the best. So it's not that I don't appreciate someone changing their film to meet their original vision. It's just that I think that the stuff that Lucas did, you know, just messes it up. It doesn't make it better. Unlike, you know, in Blade Runner, when they took out the narration and, you know, added in sequences that had been missing previously, I felt it made it a better film.
Yeah, I mean, that was to accomplishing a very specific and crucial story point, which was that Deckard was a replicant.
Right.
And in the theatrical cut, he was explicitly not a replicant. And in the later cuts, he explicitly was.
Right.
So those are important changes. I actually did like the narration, though, because that's, you know, that's a film noir standard.
Yeah, and also, the first time you're watching it, the narration is helpful, but, you know, it's one of those where I feel like if you've watched it multiple times, you know, you appreciate not having it. There is the rumor, and I don't know how true it is, people have said that Harrison Ford didn't want to do the narration, so he sort of phoned it in, because it's not very good narration. Mm-hmm. I don't know how true that is.
I like it. I mean, the if you don't like sort of the, what's the right word? It's not quite campy. But stereotypical nature of the narration, I think that's you know a nod to the film noir roots of the story. Yeah. So I like that.
So I feel like one thing we haven't really covered, even though that was kind of the point of this episode, so Brian, for you is, well, what is the hero's journey and how? Because like I said, that none of that is in Hidden Fortress. None of that came from Kurosawa.
You know, it would be interesting to pull up the 12 steps of the hero's journey and just point out each one of them in Star Wars. But I don't have that document in front of me. I wouldn't be able to find it.
Well, conceptually, it's this idea that there's a pattern, right? That there's certain predictable steps that you go through in the telling of a good story, and the hero encounters various obstacles and experiences. But that's about the extent of my knowledge of it.
Look at this. I just pulled it up with one search on my computer. I've got a practical guide to Joseph Campbell's The Hero with 1,000 Faces by Chris Vogler. Let's see if there's a numbered list of the 12 steps. Yeah, they got it. I got it right here. Want to go through these really quick?
Sure.
Sure.
Okay, step one, the hero is introduced in his ordinary world. That's Luke on the planet, not allowed to go get his moisture evaporators. Or no, not allowed to get his power converters with his friends.
Yeah, but, from Dashi Station.
Yeah.
The call to adventure. Of course, that's when Aunt Beru and Uncle Owen are killed.
Right.
Number three is the hero is reluctant at first. He says, I can't go to, that's all such a long way from here. He doesn't want to go. Number four, the hero is encouraged by the wise old man. Kind of obvious. Obi-Wan Kenobi tells him to go to Alderaan. Number five, the hero passes the first threshold.
That could be taking off from Mos Eisley.
Yeah, well, his parents died, and he was like, okay, I'm done with this, right? I'm going forward. I think that's what that is.
It could be his fight with the sand people. It could be the bar fight. Well, the bar fight is really step number six, which is the hero encounters tests and helpers. That's where he meets Han and Chewie, and where they have the bar fight.
Mm. And then, also, he does the lightsaber practice with the remote droid.
Droid. Perfect, yeah.
Number seven is the hero reaches the innermost cave, and that's no moon. It's a space station. They arrive on the Death Star.
Although I think that fits more in Empire Strikes Back when he goes into the cave and defeats Vader.
That's a pretty blatant.
Yeah.
Number eight is the hero endures the supreme ordeal. And according to Chris Vogler, that's the trash compactor.
Yeah, that would be pretty harrowing to be in there.
It would. Number nine is the hero seizes the sword. And that's they've got the plans in R2-D2 and they take them back to the rebel base. Number 10, kind of the same thing. Number 10 is the road back. That's, again, getting back to the rebel base.
Right. And they have that fight with the TIE fighters trying to get away from the Death Star and that.
Yep. Number 11 is Resurrection, where the hero emerges from the special world transformed by his experience. I wonder if that might be the fight with the TIE fighters leaving the Death Star.
It could be. That might even be when they get to the base and he's in his X-Wing pilot uniform, maybe.
Okay.
But yeah, somewhere in there. Okay.
And the final step, number 12, is return with the elixir. And that's obviously delivering the plans and the general putting it up on the screen for everyone to see the 1970s vector graphics.
Well, that's the funny thing. With all the amazing special effects they did in this, of course, probably the costly and most difficult were these really primitive digital things that now anybody on their iPhone, you know, could do with no problem at all. What always struck me was Gary Kurtz was the producer on the first couple films. He left with the third film. And, you know, he really interesting to listen to him talk because he says, look, the idea with the third film was Luke was a samurai and at the end he had done his job and he walks off into the desert alone, which I thought would be an amazing ending to this. But, you know, part of the problem was by the time they got to the end with Return of the Jedi, it was very commercial, right? Like, one of the things that really offends me is that Ewok is just the reverse of Wookiee because they were going to go to a Wookiee planet, but then they're like, you know what? We could do these dolls and we could, you know, whatever, sell them. So they reversed it to Ewok. And I'm just,
It's not as simple as that. I mean, George did explain that because originally it was supposed to be a Wookiee planet.
Right.
But the problem was he had already established Chewie as being too sophisticated for that. You know, he flies spaceships, he runs around, he does things in society. So it was no longer a good fit for this primitive world.
Yeah. I just, that film, even though, you know, there's certain things I like in the third film, mostly I like the first scene. I like the whole sequence, you know, going up to R2-D2 shooting out the lightsaber to Luke and, you know, and all that. I like that scene. But after that movie, I especially feel like in the end, and it was how George changed it, you know, when Vader says no at the end, he inserted that. To match no, whenever I forget whatever, but anyway, it was just you know, yeah. I don't like the third film.
Can we talk about deleted scenes?
Sure.
Because I don't know of that many. This is something I've never looked into. I've seen the scene in the hangar at the Rebel base where the commander comes up. Luke and Biggs are having a conversation. And the commander comes up and is really skeptical of Luke's ability to fly the INCOM T-65. Are you checked out on this? I've seen that scene. It was so badly acted that there's no way that could have stayed in the movie. I've seen a still of Luke and Biggs having a conversation on Tatooine, where Biggs, it looks like he's home on vacation or something, and saying, wow, it's an amazing world out there. Luke, you've got to come and join us. And I've seen the scene where... oh my gosh, Jabba is played by some Irish guy or something.
Well, that was the original
like a big fur cloak type thing.
That's also one of the things that pissed me off because Lucas lied about these. Like, no, I always intended him to be Jabba the Hutt, and I, you know, whatever. And like, no, this was the original character. This is what you intended. And it's you know, I mean, Jabba that's more interesting than this guy, but, you know, and then they did this funky thing when they, you know, redid the first one where they literally just move Han Solo up and over his tail. You know, it's just like, oh my God.
And it makes a little silly squeak or something when he steps on it.
Yeah.
But are there any other deleted scenes that?
Well, the thing, actually, there is actual footage of Biggs talking, and he's like, oh, you know, I don't remember what he says, but it's really bad. Like, it's really bad. And to me, that's why I say if you look at the prequel series where there's just terrible, terrible acting, that is Lucas, you know, that. Without his collaborators. I mean, you need the energy and drive and genius of Lucas with great collaborators like Ben Burtt and John Williams and his wife, Marsha Lucas, who he divorced after that. And one of the really disgusting things is after he divorced Marsha Lucas, he erased her from the history of Star Wars. And it's really disgusting, right? I mean, she was a major, major part of the success of that film as the editor. You know, but, you know, in his divorce.
That's one thing I've heard consistently is that she was much more responsible for the quality of the film than people are aware.
All right, well, I mean, okay, so we've touched on all sorts of stuff. Let's see. Let's come to an ending.
Oh, I had a question. Yeah. And this may not be the sort of thing, Brian, that you would know off the top of your head, but I figured I'd throw it out. The hero's journey, can you think off the top of your head of movies or stories where they're good even though they don't really follow the hero's journey pattern?
Interesting. I'm sure I could, but I have never really sat down to think about that, so I don't have an answer. But that's I think it would be very hard to find a movie that doesn't have some of the elements or even most of them.
Yeah, because they can, they're just kind of like tarot cards, you know, they're just broad enough that you can map them onto a lot of different things if you wanted to.
The problem with that is they're, you know, they're good story elements. And for someone to come up with a good story, an enjoyable story, a memorable story that doesn't rely on these conventions that we're all so familiar with and that we expect to see, that would be quite a feat, quite an artistic feat.
Oh, yeah.
I'd be interested to see that.
I was trying to think, like, I haven't seen it for years and years, but there's that movie Memento, which is told in reverse.
Oh, yeah.
But I don't know enough about the movie to
say whether or not. Well, you know, God, that's one of my favorite films of all time, for breaking those kind of things, I mean, yeah, there's no hero's journey in that one. Maybe the hero's journey backwards, but I'm not sure. Well, so I guess here's where we can end. Let's see where we're at. You know, Brian, what do you feel about the, you know, non-Lucas trilogy?
Yeah, I mean, that was really, really painful. I remember when... J.J., what's his name?
J.J. Abrams, yep.
I remember some guy on YouTube made a great kind of open letter to J.J. Abrams saying, please don't screw it up. Here's what's good about Star Wars, and here's what's terrible about those prequels, so please do your three properly. And it was, seems clear that he didn't get the message, because whenever he did Star Trek and he had to blow up the planet Vulcan, he goes into Star Wars, and he has to kill Han Solo. I mean, it's almost as if his motivation is just to screw up other people's work.
But also, well, I go for that. So first of all, I really appreciate J.J. Abrams. He did some good TV work. I liked the first couple seasons of Alias. And I really liked, he kind of corrected the Mission Impossible series. So the second Mission Impossible film was a disaster. And the third one, which was J.J. Abrams' very first film, was actually really good. It didn't do well because people were still reacting to the second film, but it kind of put it, you know, it made it possible to do more films.
Hmm.
The problem with J.J. Abrams is he is scared to do anything original. So when he did Star Trek, what did he do? He reversed, at least in his second film, he reversed the film where, you know, Spock died and he made it so Kirk was dying. He just took the same film and he changed one element, right? And then so one of the things that really pisses me off about him with Star Wars is the original writer was the guy who did Little Miss Sunshine and Toy Story 3, which are two amazing films. And he was focused on, let's move beyond the Skywalker thing. We need to move this universe into another place. When J.J. Abrams was put on, he fired him because he wanted to redo the original episode, you know, Star Wars A New Hope, and he wanted to bring back the original actors. And as a short-term thing, that makes sense. People are going to come back to see Mark Hamill, et cetera. But for the long term of the series, all you've done is recycle. And he redid the first film. He redid A New Hope. And then, you know, I mean, then there's a whole other set of issues because they were only going to have one director for each film. There was no plan for the trilogy. Rian, you know, Johnson came in to do the second one. I actually think he did a lot of interesting things with that film. But because this wasn't part of a cohesive vision, he just basically he reset a bunch of stuff from the first film. Then when J.J. Abrams was brought into the third film, he reset all the stuff J.J., you know, Rian had, Johnson had done. It was a disaster because there was no cohesive vision for that series.
Right.
And they were all just doing their own thing and then, you know, correcting what the previous person had done. It just, you know, but I'm going to say a lot of people accuse Rian because that was the film where things sort of dropped off. But I'm going to argue, no, it was J.J. Abrams, because he redid Star Wars instead of doing something new, and he set this whole thing off on the wrong path. And, you know, I think it'll be forgotten in the future.
I believe the Clone Wars cartoon, I've seen a few episodes of that.
You are right. The animated stuff that was done, there's actually some really good stuff there, and that is true. And I haven't watched it all, but it's actually really well done. All right, well, that's where we are. Any closing statements from anyone?
I would like to leave a final thought, which is that anyone listening who is a fan of Star Wars, and if you live in the Western U.S. or if you ever happen to visit the Western U.S., take a trip to Death Valley and go online first and find all the lists of the Death Valley shooting locations for Star Wars, because they're very specific, and you can stand exactly where Luke and Ben Kenobi were standing when they said that you'll never find a more wretched hive of scum and villainy looking down on Death Valley with Mos Eisley added to the bottom. You can see where you can see the exact camera angles where 3PO and R2 were going through the sand, and you can see the bands of color on the hillside behind. It's just a really fun experience. You can stand in the canyon where R2 was driving along before the Jawas jumped out and
Hoochika!
Well, okay, so I know that you're obsessed with Death Valley. I did not know they'd done any filming there. I thought most of that was done in
Tunisia.
Tunisia, yeah.
Mostly Tunisia was those houses, those underground little houses where the Skywalker family lives. But most of the rest of Tatooine was Death Valley because, I mean, look at the comparison in shooting compared to going to Tunisia.
Oh, sure.
Yeah, so it's close by, it's accessible, and it's really, if depending on how into Star Wars you are, it could be considered a spiritual experience, or it might just be a fun day.
Well, sounds good. Sounds like a good place to end.